Last case for argument is 2222-1227, Philip Morris v. ITC. Mr. Garr, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Judge Prost, and may it please the Court. The exclusion order at issue in this case bans the importation of a revolutionary class of heat-not-burn tobacco products that the expert agency charged with regulating tobacco products concluded is appropriate to promote the public health and expected to benefit the health of the United States population as a whole.
How does that benefit the health? Is it because it prevents people from smoking other cigarettes?
That's one aspect of it, Your Honor. The other is that the IQOS system, the FDA found, significantly reduced exposure to toxic chemicals and carcinogens.
And that led to a finding that there's benefits to the health of society as a whole?
That's correct. And this was an extraordinary action by the FDA. There's only been, I think, three products that has obtained this MRTP, a modified risk and specifically modified reduced
exposure
designation.
Were the other two instances tobacco?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Were the other two instances tobacco? You said there were still...
Yes. That's right, Your Honor. These determinations are specifically like this. And we do think that this case raises broader questions, important questions about the FDA's authority to second-guess the determinations of other expert agencies on public health and public interest issues. But ultimately, we think this case can be decided on more conventional grounds because of the plain legal defects in the underlying patents. And I'd like to identify two up front. The 123 patent is invalid for obviousness.
Can I ask you just, and I don't want to take too much time on that, but could you provide an update on the status with regard to the claims of these two patents? There's so many other proceedings ongoing.
Sure.
Can you just tell me what's going on with respect to, again, where the claims are the same in the 123 and the 915?
So there were PTAB proceedings as to both. There's an appeal of the 915 determination by the
invalidity. Where you prevailed below, right?
Right, that we prevailed below. And that is... The opening brief, I believe, is due at the end of October.
And it's all the claims, so it's the same claims that are...
They're overlapping claims, Your Honor. That's right.
And what about the 123?
The other one is on appeal, but further behind, I believe.
And what did the board do there?
In that case, in the 123 patent, they upheld the validity of it, but not with respect to the particular arguments we're making here.
But the same claim? Overlapping claims.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
So as to the 123 patent and the argument that we're making here, we believe it's invalid for obviousness for the same reason, essentially, that this court finded invalidity on that ground in the Uber Technologies case. This is a situation in which the only element at issue, the centered heater, was a subject of finite number of design options, three, that were known in the public market.
Before you get to that, can we just follow your sequence? There are lots of issues here.
Yes.
So your number one issue, at least in terms of sequentially in your blue brief, was the statutory issue.
That's right, Your Honor.
And I just want to sort of talk a little about that.
I'd love
to. The question is, do you agree that there needs to be some prejudice, even if there is an obligation to consult and the failure to fulfill that obligation,
yes,
that you would have to demonstrate prejudice?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
So that even if they consulted with the FDA here, you wouldn't be able to come behind them and say, well, what about the FTC? Right.
That's correct.
And so what is it that, I mean, this is different than the cases you cite because this comes up in the context of an adjudication and not just a rulemaking. There's lots of pages, like 10. There's much discussion about FDA statements, you know, experts talking about that. It's not like they ignored what the FDA's position on any of this was. So what's the prejudice? What could they have gleaned or would they likely have gleaned from a consultation with the FDA that they didn't already have?
Your Honor, the prejudice is the failure to engage in an interactive, deliberative process on the most fundamental issue in this case, whether the exclusion of these products...
But if the FDA put out thousands of press releases, there's plenty of documentation as to what their view is, that was all before the commission. I mean, this is after all, an adjudication, with both sides robustly putting in what the FDA's position is. What question was left unanswered?
So, first of all, I think the Ninth Circuit answered this in the California Wilderness case at pages 1093 to 95.
I think her question's more specific. I mean, we've read those cases. What specifically in this adjudicatory process do you think that the FDA would have provided? Should a briefing have been invited? What would that briefing have asked for? None of that is clear to us.
Sure, I can give you a sense, Your Honor. I mean, the fundamental question is we don't know, and that's where the prejudice is on this kind of discretionary determination. But the difficult part about the public health determination here is the balancing of the benefits of this revolutionary product and the known harms of tobacco use. And that's ultimately where I think the commission got hung up. It overweighed the
32 documents from the FDA that they considered. 32 exhibits.
But Your Honor,
but I understand. So, but it sounds like you're arguing now that maybe their balance was wrong and they abused their discretion in thinking that the public health did not weigh the injunction. So I want to make sure I understand, because I'm trying to understand what it is that you think that the ITC should have done here.
Engage in a deliberative process. That's why we're
here. What does that deliberative process look like? Again, we're in an adjudicatory process, right? It's not like, I mean, are you saying that they should call the FDA behind closed doors and say, tell us what to do? I mean, what exactly do you expect the process to look like?
The answer is yes. And again, we're talking about a statutory requirement. Congress said you shall consult.
But what about if they write the FDA and they say, do you have any comments on this? Do you have any views that you want to express on this? And the FDA says, nope, you've covered it all. Is that sufficient? Does that satisfy the consultation requirement?
It probably would, Your Honor. That didn't happen here.
Okay. What didn't happen here is that they called the FDA and said, did you have anything to say? What they did was give them notice, right?
And that's not sufficient. Notice is not consultation.
They told them in a letter specifically to a person at HHS and said, here's an investigation we're doing, right?
They posted it on a website and they put it in the Federal Register. And as the Ninth Circuit said in the California Wilderness case, notice is not consultation. Consultation
is more than that. My reading of the record is that initially they sent a letter to somebody tasked with looking at these types of reviews at the agency. Then after the ITC, after the initial decision from the ALJ was issued, then there was the notice to federal agencies generally.
There's nothing that I'm aware of in the record, Your Honor, that shows that HHS, FDA looked at this and said, we have nothing further to offer. And again, this is a statutory requirement that requires a deliberative process.
That wasn't my question. I was saying that the ITC wrote.
Right. And my answer is that's not consultation. That's a one-way communication. Consultation defined in the dictionary as understood in
cases. Well, how do we force the FDA to respond? What if they said, no, somebody called them up and said, hey, you haven't responded. They said, no, we're too busy. We don't care.
Again, I think that's a different case. We don't have that evidence in this case, but I would be surprised if FDA would do that. This is an issue of great public import. They had spent years studying this issue, and to say that there was nothing.
Can I ask you just a follow up? Because we talked about the adjudicatory process.
Sure.
What happens then under your view of the statute? You've got two parties here. So they have a meeting with the FDA. Do you get to go? Do you get to hear, have a transcript of what was said in those consultations so that the parties can respond to what the FDA said? Right?
I believe that would be an interagency process. The particulars of it could depend on the context. Here, none of that happened. I mean, we're talking about what consultation would entail. The problem here is there was no consultation whatsoever, and the commission has never argued otherwise. It simply argues that its notice equals consultation.
Well, there is, in one of those Ninth Circuit cases, there's a suggestion. I think it's actually one where the Ninth Circuit found there was sufficient consultation. I think it's Environmental Defense. Anyway, in that case, one of the things they said was having an opportunity to have the initial memo, the agency having an opportunity to see that memo and comment on it if they wanted to, was consultation. Do you think that was satisfied here? I mean, the agency was informed that there was an initial decision from an ALJ.
No, I don't think notice is consultation. I think if you looked at the dictionary definition, I think if you looked at what the cases talk about, California Wilderness case from the Ninth Circuit, notice is not consultation.
What about the fact that this has been the ITC's practice for years and years and years, and presumably
your client was aware of their practice. So what about the fact that there was no suggestion made to the LJ or the commission until very much later about what specifically should have been done by the commission in order to satisfy its statutory duty?
Sure. So I don't think this issue was ripe until the commission issued its final determination. Before the agency, the staff itself argued that the ALJ didn't have this authority. And as soon as the commission made its determination, it was clear that they had not engaged in the requisite consultation, we raised that issue in our stay request. So I think the waiver argument is misplaced. This is a statutory requirement.
You didn't have to, even though I think I would assume you're charged with knowing that this is a longstanding practice of how the agency implements the statutory requirement. And in light of that, you don't think there was any need for you to specifically ask the commission
there,
to do that?
Your Honor, I don't think there was a legal waiver in that sense. There was discussion throughout as to whether or not, and we made clear we wanted a public interest hearing, we wanted FDA involved. So it's not as though this wasn't part of the conversation. But I think, you know, even if you thought that there was some technical waiver, we don't think there is. This court has the authority to decide issues that are legal issues that have been fully briefed and that go to public importance.
What about, I had a question.
I've been here in Washington practicing law and sitting on the bench for quite a while now. And it seems to me that publication in the Federal Register, and I understand you have a Ninth Circuit opinion, but publication in the Federal Register is sufficient to put interested parties on notice. It puts them on notice, and that notice is that if you want to be heard in this particular case, come forth. That's what the notice of initiation in this particular case seems to me to do as well.
Your Honor, I simply don't think that consultation can be satisfied by mere notice.
But again, it says, shall consult with. That's what the statute says.
Exactly.
What does that mean here in this town? I mean, it's if I send a notice to Judge Prost and I say, let's talk about this, and she doesn't respond, I can't force her to talk about this, and she may not want to. But the fact that I did give her the opportunity to... Why is that not consultation itself?
I think
you're
on the
way communication that you're talking about.
Right. I mean, I think in the Ninth Circuit explained this in the California Wilderness case. Consultation, if you look in the dictionary, understanding is a deliberative process, an interchange, and simply a one-way notice is not sufficient.
That's the Ninth Circuit and not us.
Right. I would like to shift to the patent issues because I'd hate for my time to expire unless Your Honors have further questions.
We understand that we're using a lot of your time. We understand that, so don't worry about time right now.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, I wanted to ask about this. Sorry for that. I wanted to ask about your reply brief on page one. There's a statement here. You say appellants did urge the commission, the relevant decision maker, to hold hearings on the public's interest and discuss these matters directly with representatives of FDA.
Right.
Are you standing behind that crop quote?
This is what we said, Your Honor, and this is at page, I think, 14780, is that, you know, we certainly urge them to conduct a public interest hearing. And we indicated that it may be enlightening to meet with representatives of the FDA. I agree with you. We didn't make the argument as categorically as we are in our briefs today. I think that's fair, Your Honor.
I appreciate your candor.
And I do think, thank you, Your Honor, and I do think, though, that those statements were made before the ALJ, and the commission itself took the position that, and this was at Appendix 21384, that it was not delegated to the agency to engage in that. Consultation is imposed on the commission itself. That's in the statute. And so we think the commission had that duty at the final determination stage to actually engage in this interactive process. And there's no dispute that no interactive process took place.
Why would not a proceeding to review the remedial order and to amend it, why would that not suffice to an opportunity to consult?
I think, Your Honor, FDA was not part of that. Maybe the analogy I would make is you all read the briefs here today. That's obvious. But you're not deciding this case based on the briefs. We're here having this discussion, interaction, and that shows the value of interaction, deliberative process. And that's what Congress wanted on particular matters with respect to specific agencies. In this case, I mean, I think everyone agrees that at the heart of the public interest determination is a public health determination. FDA, after years of scientific study, had concluded that these products were appropriate to promote the public health.
Well, except you had an opportunity. I mean, there's plenty of documentation as to the FDA's position, and that's what the parties adjudicated. And they put forth experts, and they put forth press releases by the FDA and all this information.
Yes.
That's, let me ask you one more hypothetical, which I'm not sure was asked before. What if the ITC calls the FDA, and the FDA never returns its call?
I mean, I think there's a reasonableness element that, to Your Honor, if they never even try to get an answer, I don't think that would be consultation. If they've genuinely tried, then I think at some point.
The difference between putting a notice and serving it on them versus placing a phone call is the distinction
yes.
that you would say is, okay.
Yeah,
I will let you move on to your.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to make one closing point. In a prior world, I spent many years in government, and I can tell you from firsthand experience that there's no substitute for the interactive exchange among different agencies and different government officials in making decisions. And that simply and undeniably did not take place.
My experience has been that here in Washington, if you're not reading the Federal Register on a daily basis, you're going to miss out on a lot.
Well, I think that may be true, but I think that just underscores that no one can truly have knowledge of everything in the Federal Register. And notice is simply not enough, Your Honor. Congress said consult. It said consult with.
That's the purpose of the notices. I mean, it's one government agency talking to another one in this case.
I'll stop because I know you understand the arguments, Your Honor.
Just because
yes.
we've never let you get, just before you, I know you want to discuss 123 and obviousness, but what was yours? You said you had two
patent specific issues are 123 and the implementation of known design choices in the public art, which we think is controlled by Uber Technologies. And the second one I'd like to mention is on the 915 patent, all of the elements were in public use. The only way that the commission avoided that conclusion was by imposing a legally erroneous and impossible to meet corroboration requirement. And that's in conflict with this court's decision in Transweb and Noble Biocare. And so just briefly, Your Honor, on the 123 patent, there were three locations for the centered heater, the only element at issue in this case. The Reynolds expert acknowledged that at page 21377. All of those locations were known in the prior art. Reynolds expert acknowledged that again, 21376. There were disadvantages to non-centered heaters. Reynolds expert acknowledged that at 21377.81. And there were known benefits of centered heaters.
It seems that what drove certainly the commission, if not the ALJ, and they even called it, the commission used the words legally flawed, they seem to have some reading of our cases that suggested that you couldn't provide a missing limitation without a piece of prior art, as opposed to with expert, uncontroverted testimony.
Right.
Is that a problem, do you think?
It absolutely is. In Your Honor's own decision in that, and I wish I could pronounce it, Conan Plinkett.
We call it Phillips because we can't.
Phillips, okay. I mean, it says that the general knowledge of a person of skill in the art is sufficient to supply the missing limitations. So that was clear legal error. And the commission, and this is defended by Reynolds here, you know, also try to make this teaching away argument, which is what they're...
Well, except you don't want to go to the teaching away because I think, once again, in your briefs, the commission didn't say anything about teaching away, and the ITC and the ALJ didn't say anything about teaching away. Mm-hmm. What they did rely on is that, you know, what Morgan said about how difficult it would be. They didn't find teaching away. They didn't base their decision on teaching away, right?
I think that's a fair reading of it. I would say that the commission and Reynolds here have defended it on teaching away because the one thing that they cite is their expert's testimony at 21367. And that's where he makes the teaching away argument. There was no teaching away here.
With you there's no teaching
right.
away. Okay.
So in that situation, we have a person of skill in the art who knows that you have a finite set of options for the
what
location.
What about the ALJ's fact finding that there isn't just three places to put the heater elements? He says there's actually a lot of different places where you can put the heater elements. I'm sorry that I just want to make sure I understand because I'm not sure that there is, it's an uncontested fact that there's only three places to place the heater.
So I think, Your Honor, here's what's undisputed or indisputable, I think. It's that there, you can place it outside of the area. You can place it inside, but not centered, and inside and centered. Now, there were a number of different places that are inside and not centered that are shown in the prior art, but the fundamental question of, is the heater outside of the element, inside the element, and if it's inside the element, is it in the center of the element, or is it somewhere else around the heating cylinder? So yes, there were different ways inside of it you could put it, but the question of whether you would put it in the center, that was something that was indisputably known in the art. There were known advantages of putting it in the center, and there were known disadvantages of not putting it in the center. And so a person of skill in the art, and this is true, follows from KSR, it follows from Uber Technologies, and from the Phillips decision.
What is the legal, I'm understanding, right. I'm appreciating yes. everything you're saying. My problem, I guess, comes down to this, standard of review. And so Morgan says there are problems and this is better, and you've got at least testimony that suggests that the prior art would have viewed the central location as being desirable. Why don't we have to defer to a finding that was not enough to motivate the inventors here?
So I think, first of all, I mean, generally the obviousness is a legal question, but on that underlying question, underlying question, Your Honor, I think if you look at their expert's testimony at 21.377 to 79, and actually to 81, where he discusses the known benefits and known disadvantages. I think, as a matter of law, whether you want to look at that under substantial evidence, clear error, I mean, it's clear that he's acknowledging that a person of skill in the art would have recognized that there were benefits to the center heater and disadvantages to the non-center heater. And then you're left with the legal question of whether or not that element can be supplied. And I think the Uber Technologies case is almost exactly on point on that, Your Honor. And I think that there was clear legal error. I mean, at the bare minimum, this court should hold that the ALJ and the commission were wrong in their thinking about what the legal requirements for this analysis were in terms of what a person of skill in the art, his general knowledge could bring to the equation.
Well, is there a basis for a remand solely because the commission relied on a legally flawed argument?
Yes.
I don't think that was a legally flawed argument?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. Even if you thought that the record was sufficient, debatable, we don't think it is. But absolutely, at a minimum, we would be entitled to a remand on that. And then,
go ahead. I'll give you a couple more minutes to discuss your final issue.
Thank you, Your Honor. On corroboration and the 915 patent, the only issue is whether or not the Accord K device was in use before the priority date. And Mr. Doug Burton was a Philip Morris engineer who testified at length. Incredibly, that's not disputed, that this Accord K device practiced all the elements. There was only one Accord K device, and it was used publicly in a series of events in Miami in 2005, 2006. That testimony on its own clearly satisfies the element, but we had to corroborate that. We acknowledged that. But here the corroboration evidence was overwhelming, I would submit. And I would point you to just four things. First is the technical file, which is dated June 2004, which has an ID number.
I'd like to ask you a question about
sure.
this. I have to tell you, I did look at every single one of the documents that was cited as corroboration. What I didn't see corroborated was that the device that was provided to 600-some people in Miami is, in fact, the Accord K device.
Right.
And I didn't see that anywhere. It seems like an important point. There was nothing linking the two. Instead, there were like multiple different names for the device. And the only testimony saying that the Accord K is all those different names is, again, testimony. I mean, there's no evidence or documents. So why under a rule of reason, which I think we review as a fact finding, isn't the ALJ's finding supported by substantial evidence?
Sure. So I think we're talking about corroboration, and no one is going to, and I think as this court said in the Tramsweb, you look at that question as a whole, not on an element or specific basis. But I think the record actually does satisfy it. For example, I would say that the technical file actually uses an ID number for the Accord K device, and that's the same ID number that is found on the picture of the Accord K device in the record at page 473. It's NHAPL7. So that's an explicit document linking this Accord K device to the photograph of the device, and so I think that that in itself would be sufficient. The March 2006 research report refers to it as the next smoking device, and that was something that Mr. Burton testified was one of the ways to refer to it. In the 2006 slide deck at 41477 referred to it not only as next smoking, but the EHCSS Series K, and then you look at that document, and it has a picture of the IQOS device that says Accord on it, appendix 41477, and there are many other documents that we've discussed at pages 56 to 62 of the brief. I mean, the real question is, at what point is corroboration enough? I mean, we're not going to have a videotape of the Miami events in 2005, 2006, but we have the testimony that's not disputed to be, that is credible, and no one argues otherwise, that's detailed by Mr. Burton explaining that he was an expert, involved in the design and use of this device, brought it down to Miami, showed these people, and then we have all these documents using the same shorthand, the same way we refer to the device, the same identification number of the device, linking it to that time frame. And under a rule of reason analysis that looks to the documentary evidence as a whole and determines whether there is corroboration, I mean, I would submit in any other context, this would corroborate that the Corte device was actually shown in Miami in 2005, 2006. Any other legal conclusion in this case would be error and would impose a impossible-to-meet corroboration standard that couldn't stand with this Court's decision in Transweb or its decision in Noble BioCare. Thank you, Your Honors.
We will restore a little rebuttal. Let's hear from the other side, which has a split argument. So we will hear from the Commission first. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed. Good morning.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I'd like to start with Philip Morris's statutory argument regarding the consult with language of Section 337. You know, as the Court observed, there's many of these details, such as what the further consultation would even entail. They're just not in the record because the argument was never raised below. Philip Morris is incorrect that the issue was not ripe until the Commission's final determination. Philip Morris was required to specifically assert its statutory argument during the investigation, and there are cases in the Commission's brief on that point, on pages 34 to 35, and at page
4. Not before the ALJ, but before the Commission's review.
I think during the investigation, because it relates to the public interest factors. So if
there's this dust up before the ALJ, where the ALJ sort of on his own sort of asked about this requirement. And my read was that the government took the position that no, the ALJ has nothing to do with this and nothing to say about it because the Commission has not delegated that authority to him in terms of the consultation. Am I misreading the record?
So I think I'd like to clarify two points on that. First, I think the consultation relates to both the domestic industry products, Reynolds product status, and also the public interest. So for the ALJ's statement on the record was related to the status of the domestic industry products of Reynolds and their FDA authorization. Here, for the public interest factors, the Commission did order that the ALJ make findings of fact as to the public interest, and that was in the notice of investigation. So we do have the ALJ as a finder of fact on both issues that relate to the consult with statutory argument. So Philip Morris should have raised it before the ALJ. Now, in a Commission proceeding, once the ALJ issues his final initial determination, the Commission issues additional Federal Register notices seeking public interest and remedy briefing from the parties, from the public, from interested government agencies. And that gives the parties and the interested government agencies another opportunity to come forward with
it. Okay, but given the statutory language of consult, you're talking about notice. I mean, is there anything more than notice that was provided to these government agencies?
So, Your Honor is correct.
Can you just answer my question?
Yes. So, I believe that the notice was in both the Federal Register notice and the service of the notice of investigation.
So, there was notice given.
Absolutely.
And but the statute doesn't, I mean, that's not where the statute begins or ends. The statute talks about consultation. You would agree, would you not, that consultation and notice are two different, very different things? Right.
I think the statute states consultation, comma, and you know, to seek information from, and that's what the
okay. So it requires more than notice, right? By its terms,
it requires to seek information from. Yes. So in that way, by service of the notice of investigation.
So it requires more than notice, right?
I think it requires that the Commission keeps the interested government agencies apprised of what the subject matter is of the investigation and gives them a chance to respond. But that covers a number of different things under
the rules. Notice in this case, a Federal Register notice, provide an invitation to receive comments from interested parties?
That's correct. There are multiple times during the investigation. I think that's why I'm struggling to answer your question directly.
Could you tell us with the different times in which the commission or ALJ reached out to provide notice?
So in the Federal Register notices, there's an invitation to submit briefing, and that's before the status of, before the investigation is even instituted. When we receive a complaint.
That's to everyone.
To everyone.
What about to the HHS?
To HHS, the notice of investigation is served on the designated attorney for HHS.
And then what happened later? What was the continual communication with the agencies?
So then we rely on the Federal Register notices. And that's...
And those Register notices said what?
The Federal Register notices state that they're the subject matter of the investigation, the status, because they're at different times, and they invite the public and any interested government agencies, possibly even beyond those.
At what times were those sent? I think I read in the record
Yes. There
was one that was sent after the ALJ's decision.
Yes, after the ALJ's decision, there is an initial notice that requests a briefing from everyone. There's also another request at the weather to review notice is, I think, how it's referred to. That also asks for more public interest briefing. And the commission takes it very seriously, and we followed our rules here, and we know that these rules work.
So, I mean, I guess, let me hypothetically, it seems to me like what you're saying is that the statute more or less says the consultation shall be with anyone in the universe. I mean, did they do anything more with respect to the FDA or the HHS than they did to the public beyond notifying them that if you have anything to say, you can come? Would you agree that they treated them all the same?
So the one difference would be the notice of investigation, and that is actually served on the attorney.
Okay,
part,
so there's service. But you wouldn't say that there's an obligation for them to consult with the public, right? That's all treated as notice. It's under the rubric of the heading notice. It's yes, not right. Under the rubric consultation. So where is the extra step? Are you saying they don't need an extra step? Is the only extra step you've told us about is service. So in terms of satisfying a consultation requirement that is different than a notice requirement, you're saying actual service is sufficient.
Actual service has been sufficient, and I can point to two examples where this has worked, where we have had commentary from other government agencies. Recently,
I think you had that in your briefing.
The Federal Trade Commission supplied a letter regarding a different investigation. We also know in the Ameren appeal, actually before this court, it was never instituted because the FDA weighed in prior to the institution of the investigation because the underlying issue related to the FDCA.
Are you aware of any circumstances in which either at the party's urging or at the commission's own action or the ALJ's own action, the FDA or HHS or the other agencies identified in the statute were actually contacted more than this process that you've just told us about?
I'm not aware of any other examples, just the Ameren case. And in that case, we know that the FDA provided comments prior to the institution.
Can I just move on to this unlawful articles issue, which I know Mr. Garr didn't spend any time on, but I just have a sort of hypothetical question. There have been regulatory developments since this case. Philip Morris argues that a remand is necessary to take stock of regulatory developments. Let's assume hypothetically that even though the timing didn't work out, 5 days later, the FDA rejected all of this stuff. Would there be a basis for coming in and said they couldn't use them lawfully? Would there be a basis to come in and revisit and reopen this matter?
So before the commission, if there's a material change in fact, a party can petition the commission to modify the enforcement orders. So in your hypothetical, let's say a company went bankrupt and stopped selling a product, the parties would come back to the commission.
Well, let's assume that they had been rejected.
If there, let's say there was an enforcement order from the FDA banning their sale.
Yeah.
If that was after the enforcement orders had issued, the parties would petition the commission, because it's a material change of fact, to modify the enforcement proceeding, or enforcement order in a proceeding.
Now, I know your time's up, but I'd like, before we go to the your colleague, go to the patent-specific issues that Mr. Garr raised.
And yes.
Mainly to the 123 argument. The commission, I mean, the ALJ was brief. He made a few points, and maybe that's sufficient, and maybe it's not. But the commission seemed to add on. And it added on, as my read, two things. The first being that there's this legally flawed analysis that I guess PM was raising that says that you can provide a missing limitation by what expert testimony and what the prior art is. Isn't that wrong as a legal matter under our case law?
I think that it depends on the facts of the case. I agree that it can be inconsistent with the Phillips case that counsel mentioned. And we don't focus on that point in our brief.
Well, leaving your brief aside, we're reviewing the commission's finding.
Yes.
And is it fair to conclude that that was one of the legs in the stool? That's one of the things, bases that the commission relied on to affirm the ALJ on this obviousness finding? And if that's true, and if you seem to kind of agree with me that that was legal error, isn't that a basis for remanding that analysis?
I think there were at least two different reasons for finding that they didn't prove invalidity here. One is that they didn't show the motivation to combine, and then the analysis under Arendi, I think, was a separate analysis. So it doesn't require a remand because we still have the issue that Philip Morris never proved a motivation to combine the primary reference Morgan, which teaches sequential heating using multiple heaters and replacing all those multiple heaters in the sequential heating with a single-centered heater that's in the general knowledge of a person of ordinary skill. That finding alone is enough to find that the invalidity wasn't shown by clear and convincing evidence.
And you've got prior art, undisputed testimony by experts from both sides saying central heaters were in the prior art. There were numerous advantages to central heating. So that's on the one side. And then you've got the Morgan reference, which says there are problems.
The Morgan reference, Reynolds' expert testimony, and also the other references that are in the record. And those are included at least
well,
three.
What about Reynolds' expert testimony? Because didn't they, they agreed it was in the prior art. Central heating was in the prior art, correct?
That is correct.
And they agreed that there were significant advantages to using central heating.
So they agreed that there could be advantages to using a single-centered heater, but they also the expert also testified there were numerous disadvantages.
I know, but isn't our case law replete with examples that say, leaving aside the teaching away, if this is not a teaching away, and there was no finding that this is a teaching away, that just because it's not the best, or just because there are certain advantages but also disadvantages, that's not enough to obviate the motivation?
No, that's right. But I think if we look at not whether the combination could have been made, but would a person of ordinary skill have been motivated based on the teachings of the prior art? So we know that Morgan highlights you should not reheat this tobacco or it has unpleasant flavors. And that's why it has the multiple heaters and it uses them in sequence. If you use a centered heater, a single centered heater, there are no benefits unless you have a single centered heater. You don't reduce your manufacturing costs by adding a centered heater. And so we're talking about, is there...
What if there was not testimony? What if there was a prior art? I don't want to call Adams or something, but there was some prior art that said exactly what the expert said, which is there are plenty of advantages for central heating. Go for central heating. So you've got that piece of prior art, and you've got the Morgan, which says kind of something different. Isn't that enough to say there's a motivation, as long as there's no teaching away that you would combine the two?
I think that we have to look at the references as a whole, and because their focus is on this sequential heating and not reheating the tobacco, unless there was something to that centered heater disclosure in the reference that would also address those issues, that wouldn't solve the problem. It's similar to the Alliance.
What did you? I'm sorry, I didn't catch. You were talking quickly, as I do.
I apologize. I realize I'm also out of time, but I want to make sure I answer your question.
Yes, please.
So when we're looking at Morgan's teaching of sequential heating with multiple heaters and then a single centered heater, you would need something in that reference that discloses the centered heater that also addresses this idea of a sequential heating so you're not reheating the tobacco. And there could be a reference like that, but Philip Morris made the decision not to
deal with that. How? To say that's wrong? To say ours is better in any event? What would they have to say to overcome it?
There would need to be a teaching as to how to avoid or address this reheating issue. So Morgan, for example, addresses the thermal inefficiency issue because it states you can remove the tobacco from the center and place a non-tobacco filler. So something like that in a reference could possibly take care of that motivation issue. But again, we know there's a centered heater. It doesn't mean just because you could combine it, we have to look at the motivation. And coming back to the substantial evidence standard, we do have Reynolds' expert testimony, and we have the references themselves, three of which are Philip Morris's own patents that do talk about drawbacks to a centered heater.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we hear from him?
If I could just make a quick comment on the 915 patent invalidity regarding the corroboration standard. I think that, you know, Judge Stoll hit it right on the head with this issue is the multiple devices that are in these documents versus one former employee's testimony that the Accord K, there's only one Accord K device, which is not corroborated. We don't have a list of all the versions or all the different names that were possibly used. And that uncorroborated testimony from the same witness is being used to corroborate testimony that the multiple devices shown in the documents were the same as the device in Miami. And that circular reasoning has previously been rejected by this court. So we would believe that the commission used the correct legal standard.
Do you have a particular case you're referring to when you say that circular reason has been rejected?
Absolutely. The In Re NTP case is cited in the commission's brief. It was a slightly different issue regarding the date of a document, but it's the same issue where you have one witness's uncorroborated testimony being used to corroborate another point that's needed to fix those prior holes. And I think we can look at the Finnegan case. What was expected to be seen here from a very large company is more than one former employee and an actual document trail. There's no email stating this is what you're going to take. Their witness even said that the documents don't say anywhere that this is a device you'll take to Miami. And we expect to see those paper trails in this day and age, and it's just not present here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. I stand here ready to address any of the issues that the court wants to further discuss with me, but I propose to focus on the two patent issues. And Judge Prost, let me start with your concern about the Phillips case and what the commission did here. You've mentioned a couple of times in your colloquy with my friends here the commission's use of the term legally flawed. That's at page 37 of the appendix. But look at what the commission was saying there. The commission, citing Arendi versus Apple, was saying that there are three caveats. It's not saying you can never use common sense to supply a missing claim limitation. The commission is saying quite accurately under Arendi that there are three caveats to doing that. And first, common sense is typically, not always, but typically invoked to provide a known motivation to combine and not to supply a missing claim limitation. Well, at page appendix 37, there are quotes around that. That is a direct quote, or almost a direct quote from the Arendi decision. Second, in cases where common sense was invoked to supply a limitation that was admittedly missing, and that's the commission recognizing, I think contrary to the premise of your question to my friend over here, that the commission thought that it could never use common sense to supply a missing claim limitation. The commission says here, again, quoting Arendi, that the limitation has to be unusually simple and the technology particularly straightforward. Now, this is a very important point in this case because that's where Philip Morris's case failed, as a matter of fact. Now, I have to be careful here because this is one of the few areas of the record where there is confidential information, so I'll only be general about it. But
they cite Arendi, but we've talked about Phillips, the case that we can't pronounce. And that really does explain, clarifies it, what Arendi does and doesn't do. And their quote for Arendi that common sense cannot be used as a wholesale substitute for reasoned analysis and evidentiary support. Well, that's a given. But as in Phillips, there was evidentiary support. In this case, there were witness experts from both sides. It wasn't disputed. This was in the prior art. So Arendi says what it says, and it's right. But there was no reasoned analysis. There were conclusory statements. So this is distinguishable for Arendi, and somehow they thought Arendi controlled.
Well, I don't think there's any reason to view Phillips and Arendi as case law that's in contradistinction to one another.
No.
I think quite the contrary. I think even under Phillips, the court would not have allowed such a complicated and conflicting sort of addition like a central heater here to satisfy the what Arendi calls the unusually simple and the technology particularly straightforward.
Is your view that central heaters weren't known in the prior art and that their advantages to using central heating was not known in the prior art? Because I thought both witnesses from both sides agreed with that.
Known, perhaps, but look at the finding again at page A30, appendix 37, where the commission says that circumferential spaced heaters are the state of the art as of the critical date in this case. Mm-hmm. So the fact that it might have been known doesn't mean that it was enough to satisfy what the law requires, which is, if this were, we were talking about a separate reference rather than simply common sense, the motivation to combine. What's the motivation to combine something that's known but not state of the art with this particular Morgan 1993 reference? And here is where both the record and the findings of the commission and the standard of review are not Philip Morris's friends. Philip Morris, and here again, this is where I want to be careful, so I'm going to be general. Philip Morris started trying to design the IQOS device in the mid-first decade of the 2000s, roughly 15 years after Morgan, which, by the way, is their own patent. It's their own inventor.
Well, the one of their answers to that is that you have to use the time of the invention.
Well, and that's it. Well, you're looking at the time of the invention, but look at what we're talking about, common sense. Look at what common sense tells us about the record here. Philip Morris, as Judge Stoll noted, used far more than three possibilities. They used a lot of people. It took them a lot of years. And they used at least a significant multiple of the three locations and
so are you saying that goes to motivation? They wouldn't have been motivated to combine it because it took a long time and it was complicated?
No, I'm saying that the proof is in the pudding here, Your Honor. That there was no motivation to combine because they had Morgan, it was their own patent. And instead it took them a long, expensive period of time to come up with the central heater. And whether or not there was a teaching away in Morgan, let's remember one other thing about Morgan. And that is not only did...
No, but I just want... I guess it's not like I'm disagreeing with you. I'm just not clear on what we're talking about here. Is the fact that it's complicated and it took a long, might take a long time to put together an answer to why there was no motivation to combine?
I think in part the motive... Well, if first of all, the motivation to combine finding here is based not just on the Morgan reference and the Philip Morris design story, but also on the testimony of experts. Beyond that...
Testimony of, in what regard? I mean, there's lots of testimony in this case. I mean, I thought the experts agreed that this was in the prior art, and the experts agreed, or there was no disagreement, the experts agreed that there were a lot of advantages to the central.
Yes, and that's where I was actually going with regard to Morgan, because remember that Morgan, in addition to teaching circumferential spaced multiple heaters, also teaches about removing the tobacco from the center and instead replacing it with a fiber plug. And that's because the whole notion of, again, remember, finding a fact state of the art at the relevant time is circumferential spaced heaters, not a central heater, even though possibly known. I can grant you that it's possible that it's known in the art at the time, and it still doesn't show a motivation to combine it here with Morgan. And because, and it's because Morgan doesn't even have tobacco in its in one of its preferred embodiments. It doesn't even have tobacco in the center. So there's no motivation to combine a central heater to put into to burn fiber. That's not going to do the job. You have to go far beyond what Morgan teaches in combining what a centered heater might do in order to.
I'm not sure I understand what your position is. It sounds like you're saying maybe it's harmless error. I'm not sure what you're saying about the Phillips case.
I don't think it's error at all. Let's start there. Because I think that Phillips is completely consistent with Arendi's caveats. Remember, Arendi isn't a holding that says you can never use common sense to supply a missing claim limitation. It just says be careful about it because anybody can make up anything after the fact. So, and Phillips is a case where it's relatively simple and it's fine to provide common sense and.
Do you think the commission actually though credited that testimony anyway? Because I was looking at page A38 and it says merely contending that Opposa would have been aware of the, it says possible internal heating arrangement. I assume that means the central heating arrangement doesn't establish that Opposa would have been motivated to modify.
I think that's completely consistent with what I'm saying. I hope I'm not confusing the matter by my answers to Judge Prost here. I think that this is the difference between what the state of the art is versus merely having something known in the art. And this is where the commission is saying, Philip Morris, you failed as a matter of proof. You're just contending that a person of ordinary skill would have been aware of a possible internal heating arrangement. But that doesn't go so far as to say that a person of ordinary skill would have been motivated to make the modification. And while there isn't a teaching away finding on this record, we're pretty darn close to one here with regard to Morgan. So at the very least, that the fact that Morgan does not really easily allow for just the input of a centered heater because it would start burning fiber instead of tobacco in the middle, that's a pretty powerful indication that the commission was right with regard to its fact-finding and right to tax Philip Morris with a failure of proof in its case. And remember, it's not just their burden, but it's their burden by clear and convincing evidence. And so, unless you have more questions on 123, I'll just say with regard to the 915 that I think Judge Stoll, this is a finding of fact. Again, the standard of review is not their friend. It's a more than a scintilla standard on an administrative review. And I think I'll adopt the argument made by my friends at the ITC here. I think they've made our point as well as we could.
Thank you.
So unless you've got any further questions, either on the patent issues or on any of the other issues, we would urge that the court affirm.
We've all kind of lost control of the time, but I'll really restore 3 minutes. I think that makes it somewhat even, I think.
Before you start, can I ask you one quick question? In your brief, blue brief at page 19, the top of the sentence, it's in italics, and it says, it is undisputed that at no point during the investigation did the commission consult with the FDA or any other federal agency. Are you going to maintain that, the it is undisputed part?
Well, I heard the commission this morning to say that they had general notice and that was it. I mean, that's what I understood my colleague to say. So maybe we're...
It's the word is consult with.
Consult.
It's going to be a different, that's a big issue in this case. What is the meaning of consult?
Right. So, and I think we laid out in our brief what we think the meaning is in terms of deliberative interactive process.
So this sentence means it's undisputed with your interpretation.
Yes, it is. And I'm sorry if that was confusing, Your Honor.
That was a little confusing.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. But on the consultation issue, I do want to just make 2 points. One is that I did understand my friend from the commission to acknowledge today that the only thing that they had is general notice that would have been to the public, and they happen to include the agencies. And then what I would do is read from the Ninth Circuit's decision in California Wilderness, which I understand is controlling this court, but we think is persuasive. And this is what the Ninth Circuit said. quote, DOE's interpretation of consult to mean no more than notice and comment would render part of the statute superfluous. If consultation means no more than an opportunity for comment, there is no reason for Congress to use distinct language in these other provisions. And I think that's true generally as to notice and comment
schemes. Am I correct that Philip Morris met with the FDA or USTR?
We attempted to, Your Honor. I mean, we had discussions, but that's obviously not the agency. I mean, it's the interactive process between agencies where they could say, well, you know, you said you made this reduced exposure finding and that there would be reduced exposure to carcinogens and it would help people stop smoking. But then there are these countervailing benefits. How do we weigh those? What's the impact on this? What does it mean if we exclude this device that has helped millions of smokers around the world transition to a less harmful product from combustible cigarettes? That discussion never took place.
But why I hate to belabor this, but why isn't specific service enough? Why is that any different than a phone call to an agency, which I think we all agreed you call the agency if they don't return the call, good enough?
We don't know that they never said, and we're not going to talk to you. We don't care. We don't know if they didn't see the notice. And Congress wanted consultation. It wanted consultation, an interactive process that never took place. On the 123 patent, I would say we agree with you, Judge Prost, in terms of your comments that this was, there's no question the locations were known in the art and that their expert acknowledged that there were benefits to the centered location. There was a clear motivation to use the centered location. The fact that we spent time developing this underscores the motivation. And that time was spent not to determine what the location of the heating element would be, but to design the heating element, the design blade. And that's at Appendix 416-81-82. And then on corroboration, I think the photograph that I mentioned to you, Your Honor, answers your question about specific corroboration of use of the same identification number on the Accord-K device.
Do you have a site specifically for that?
Yes. The photograph is 40073, and the technical file using the same identification number on the photograph is 40791. I would end, though, by saying that we think that this is a clear error of law. I mean, this is what this court said in the TransWeb case. At page 1301, importantly, the rule of reason analysis does not require that every detail of the testimony be independently and conclusively supported by the corroborating evidence. Yes, whether they use the Accord-K device in Miami is important, but there was overwhelming evidence corroborating that the device was used in Miami, that it used the same shorthands, the identification number, the EHCCS identification, the next smoking identification. These are all over the documents. Mr. Burton, who is an engineer at Philip Morris for years and knew directly about this, testified about it. You don't exclude the testimony itself. You look at it in light of the documentary evidence. Contemporary.
Okay. One final question I really have to ask, because you need to win on both the 915 and the 123 here.
So I think that's
rid of the exclusion order, right? I mean, there's other stuff going on that you mentioned, but in terms of reversal here, you would have to win on both patent-specific issues, right?
I think that's right with this caveat, Your Honor. First, it's very important for this court to address both patents because they're interrelated appeals. And for example, if the PTAB appeal were to affirm the invalidity of 915, this court addressed the 123, then that would, you know, be very important. I also think
But that's not my question.
Yes.
I'm talking about this case and the result in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, I think there's separate questions about the scope of the domestic industry and how it affects the patents. But I think that the basic answer is yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. We thank all sides. The case is submitted. This concludes our proceedings.